It's time to defend our title as the Best Science in Medicine podcast. The podcast award nominations start July 1st, so we need you listeners to get DNA Today nominated at podcastawards.com. DNA Today has won for the past 2 years, and this September, we are celebrating 10 years of DNA Today. All of this is because of your support, and we are so grateful to have such an incredible listener base, including you. We have been up against popular podcasts with huge production companies, which is why as a small independent podcast, we rely on each and every one of you to get nominated and hopefully win again for the third time. So please go to podcastawards.com and select DNA Today in the Science and Medicine category. Pause the show now. I swear it takes 30 seconds to do it. Podcastawards.com, DNA Today in the Science and Medicine category. Thank you oh so much.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, we have you covered. For a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. Laura Hersher is joining us for this episode. She's a returning guest previously on episode 157 of DNA Today. She is a rock star in genetics. Laura Hersher is the host of the Beagle Has Landed podcast. She's also on the team at Sarah Lawrence College's genetic counseling program that I graduated from a couple years ago. There, she coordinates student research, directing the ethics course and the weekly current events discussion that we call MAD, Monday Afternoon Discussion. As most, if not all of you at this point, has heard, the U.S. Supreme Court released its decision on Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization on Friday, June 24th, voting to overturn Roe v. Wade in the 1973 ruling that guaranteed federal constitutional protections of abortion rights. So in this discussion, sort of breaking news episode of DNA Today, we're going to be explaining the abortion laws and then how it specifically affects genetic counseling. I want to have two shout outs before we bring on Laura Hersher. I want to recommend, again, her podcast, The Beagle Has Landed, specifically the episode with Jordan Brown that talks about abortion law. I learned a lot in this episode. I also want to thank Mason Bratbo, a current genetic counseling student at Sarah Lawrence, for helping me prepare for this episode. Well, thank you so much, Laura Hersher, for coming back on the show. You were on our NSGC recap where we also talked about, at that point, we were talking about Texas SB 8, but I don't want to say it's lovely to have you back on because the reasons we've always had you on is because abortion law has changed. But I really appreciate your insight as we dive into, you know, abortion, you know, Roe v. Wade being overturned, and then also really how that affects genetic counseling specifically.
Well, thanks for having me here, Kira. I'm a big fan of what you do on this podcast.
And I was saying for listeners, I was saying to Laura that she's a part of the faculty at Sarah Lawrence College in the genetic counseling program. And one of the reasons I went to Sarah Lawrence and kind of have pursued a lot of science communication here is because of Laura. So it's like, I want to be a Laura Hersher when I grow up kind of thing. So I'm still manifesting
it's
that.
Very sweet. Very sweet. Yeah. I'm going to have you write that at the bottom of my performance review. So.
Perfect. Yeah. Yes. I'll send that over to Claire and Lindsay at Sarah Lawrence.
Yeah.
But I figured, why don't we start with a very general question for those that didn't see the news on Friday or are confused by what it means? What is the effect of Roe being overturned, and what did it previously protect?
So Roe guaranteed every woman in the United States, in all 50 states, the right to access abortions. Initially it was used a trimester screen, so it was like through the second trimester. Later on under Casey, they sort of changed that a little bit to say through viability, but also introduced something called the undue burden standard, which meant that it allowed states to pass laws. And this is actually sort of important to the discussion. You know, it just sounds like history. It allowed states to pass laws that made getting an abortion more difficult as long as it didn't create what was called an undue burden. And states really, they really were creative around that and pushed. And for that reason, there are lots of states in which before Dobbs, it was difficult for people to get an abortion in one way or another. So we're not entirely without experience to what restrictions on abortion mean. And so in some sense, we're building here on, you know, we're not just saying like, oh, let's dream about what's going to happen. We have evidence of what is going to happen because we've already seen it. But Dobbs is a whole new ballgame where they simply sort of said, there's no federal standard guaranteeing anything. There's nothing in the Constitution, according to this decision, this abominable decision, that guarantees a woman or a person's right to get an abortion. And what that doesn't do, and I think there was originally some confusion about this, although I suspect by now everybody knows, it doesn't do is make abortion illegal. It returns it to the states. And it basically said, any state can pass whatever law they want about this. Probably that the one exception would that be maternal health or the person who's carrying the child, if their life is threatened. I suspect that if there's laws without exceptions, those could still be challenged. And so there might be some like sort of around the edges looking at that. And I think that's actually an interesting area to talk about. But basically, we're going to... So what we're not going to see, which I think there's some confusion about today, is every anti-abortion state is not going to immediately pass a law saying no abortions are legal in the state. I think we're going to see a big patchwork. So you're going to have certain states where the electorate would push back that are only going to pass a law saying you can't have any abortions after 15 weeks, or you can't have any abortions after 8 weeks, or whatever standard is they choose to. But there already are certain states that have passed and have laws gone into effect that say there's simply no abortion permissible.
So let's get into that, because I have to say, as someone that doesn't, you know, I think you have a lot more experience in terms of understanding laws and how that works. So last couple of weeks, I've heard a lot about trigger laws, and I had never heard of this before. What is a trigger law? When will these go into effect? Because as you've been saying, it's up to now the individual states, which I think is a really important thing you mentioned. And we're going to get to exceptions, because I have a lot of questions in terms of especially genetics. But let's start with like trigger law. How does that work state-based?
Trigger law simply says that the state, so if the state passed a law, which Oklahoma did before Dobbs was overturned, saying there's no abortion legal in this state, they knew Dobbs was coming, right? So that, but technically, if you'd passed that law 2 years ago, it would have gotten challenged. It would have gone to the first level of court, and the first level of court would say, well, clearly under Roe, this is illegal. And, you know, so they could have passed a law like Mississippi did with the intent of having it go to the Supreme Court and have Roe overturned. But a trigger law, but that's actually expensive for a state, right? They have to pursue it. It's a process. So a trigger law doesn't challenge Roe. It says the minute Roe is overturned in this state, this is the law. And there's a mix of things that are trigger laws that were passed with that intention and things that were simply remained on the books from before 1973. And the question is, are those laws now in effect?
So they were just kind of waiting.
You're seeing a lot of stuff at the state level where things, you know, you're hearing, seeing headlines saying this state is allowing the law to go into effect. This judge is allowing the law. This judge is not allowing the law to go into effect. Those are, I would just say, bumps in the road as far as the states are concerned. The judges aren't really saying, no, you're not going to be allowed to put this law into effect. They're probably looking at technicalities and the way that the law is being implemented. And, you know, is it right this minute? Is it 30 days or something?
Yeah, because I've seen some of that. It's like, I didn't know if it was, okay, now starting, I don't know, the next business day, right? Like Monday that it started, okay, now these are in effect, or if it's 30 days. I've seen a lot of difference on social media and I'm like, okay, I got to look at my sources here.
So the important thing here is just to understand that this kind of state by state situation is the new reality for us, as has been the reality with lots of other things that don't have a federal decision, right? Like when you look at surrogacy, surrogacy is protected. There's certain states like California where they're like, they said the state will back up the contract, right? Like you can go to court and sure. And there's other states where writing that contract is a felony. And then there's in between states where they just simply don't have a law in the books, and it's kind of, you know, at your own risk, like you're not sure how the court will react. So each one of the states is going to have their own sort of legal back and forth, as one does about a new law, you know, where maybe some part of the law will get questioned. But basically the law in each state will be slightly different from every other state.
Right. And so for states that have protections, so that people can have abortions. So we're New York, Connecticut based. In your state of New York, people can terminate up to 26 weeks. In Connecticut, it's 24 weeks. I work right on the state line, so it's certainly relevant for me. So we are certainly, I'm very grateful to be living and working with patients in these states. So it won't change, right? In Connecticut, New York, other places, and on the West Coast that also has protections. It's more in the middle of the country where there seems to be more bans.
Yeah. Well, some of the West, the Midwest and the South, certainly those are going to be the most affected areas. And yeah, but even within the bans, there'll be slight variations.
So it's not necessarily a complete ban of can never get an abortion. It also depends on the state, of course, as we've been saying. But it seems like for a lot of states, it's going to be up to a certain number of weeks.
Well, Oklahoma's law, for instance, a lot of these trigger laws are just straight up bans. They're not saying up to a certain number of weeks. I think the law that's been proposed in Florida is up to a gestational age limit. And some of these things will reflect an electorate, like you have a more purple. But in other, you know, this entire thing doesn't actually reflect the electorate. If you were talking about what reflects the American electorate is clearly pro-choice and was against this ruling.
HemaShare Therapeutics is dedicated to developing therapies that help improve the lives of patients with rare genetic diseases. HemaShare scientists have developed an investigational therapy to treat methylmalonic acidemia and propionic acidemia. These ultra-rare genetic diseases lead to the rapid buildup of toxins in the body. Patients can suffer from intellectual disability, liver, kidney, or cardiac disease, and other life-threatening conditions. HemaShare is conducting a clinical trial to assess if their drug may be effective in the treatment of both methylmalonic acidemia and propionic acidemia. Learn more about HemaShare and these ultra-rare metabolic diseases in episode 188 of DNA Today. You can also visit HemaShare.com. That's HemaShare.com. PerkinElmer Genomics is a global leader in genetic testing, focusing on rare diseases, inherited disorders, newborn screening, and hereditary cancer. Testing services support the full continuum of care from preconception and prenatal to neonatal, pediatric, and adult. Testing options include sequencing for targeted genes, multiple genes, the whole exome or genome, and copy number variations. Using a simple saliva or blood sample, PerkinElmer Genomics answers complex genetic questions that can proactively inform patient care and end the diagnostic odyssey for families. Learn more at PerkinElmerGenomics.com.
There's also like subtle things, Kira, which may not affect the average person that much, but might have an impact in terms of genetic counseling. For instance, the Oklahoma law says no, that it declares life as beginning at fertilization, but it describes only an implanted pregnancy as counting. And that clearly that language is in there to try and say like, oh, we're okay with IVF because people like IVF. So how exactly they define when a pregnancy starts could affect whether or not you're allowed to create and freeze embryos, could affect whether or not you're allowed to do stem cell work, could affect a lot of things where embryos that aren't implanted are involved. So this goes beyond
just like a current pregnancy. I didn't realize this. That is a huge effect on genetic counseling.
So there's a lot of discussion about whether or not this could affect fertility businesses. And most of the lawyers that I've seen have said, look, IVF is extremely popular. It doesn't capture like even for the most part, even in sort of the strong anti-abortion, they're not fighting about IVF. And so most of the laws, they will try to craft them to not involve IVF. But honestly, I think if I were an IVF doc, right? And I'm putting in the money to start a clinic. Why would you want to work somewhere where the laws change all the time and you have to like worry about whether you're on the right side of legal liability? You know that contemporary IVF relies on freezing embryos for sort of almost all of its procedures. And so I think that it's a decent prediction that fewer IVF centers will choose to work in these areas. And the net effect of that is this would be a recurring theme in the net effect of what all these laws are, will be to make IVF more expensive for those people who live in those areas, right? And so you have to travel and make it an even more privileged option.
Yes, so. And I know that's a topic that just from being a student of yours, obviously you're very passionate about all of this, but certainly how this can disproportionately affect people. So who can afford or have the means to travel to states to either access, as we're talking about, reproductive technology or access abortions? I mean, so it is legal to travel somewhere. Say you're living in Oklahoma, you could travel up to us in New York, have an abortion and come back. From what I'm understanding, I don't know, correct me.
So there has been a lot of talk about whether or not there have been bills proposed or discussion of ways to criminalize people leaving their state to get abortion. That seems to me and to a lot of other people and to the Attorney General of the United States a ridiculous concept.
All of this is ridiculous to begin with, right? But yes, especially right? That. Yes.
So this is like, Kira, you live in Connecticut. Is pot legal in Connecticut now?
Not yet, but I expect soon because New York, Massachusetts, everywhere around us is.
Okay. But let's say that Connecticut still has its laws on the books. And let's say that Connecticut tried to pass a law saying if Kira goes for the night into New York City where pot is legal and takes a gummy.
They look at my license and they're like, right. Hey,
we can prosecute you for this crime. So that seems crazy, right? That's not true about anything else. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when they talk about precedents for this sort of thing, they go all the way back to slavery and the attempts of slave states to say like, you're still subject to the laws of Mississippi, even if you're in New York. But it's a real enough threat. It's a real enough threat that Merrick Garland mentioned it in the statement he made on the day that Dobbs was overturned. He mentioned two things to say that the Justice Department strongly feels these things are protected. One is interstate travel, meaning your right to leave the state. And he wouldn't have mentioned them if he didn't think they were threatened. And the other, very significantly for genetic counselors, Merrick Garland said, and you have the right to be counseled about all of your options.
That's us.
That's could have been talking to genetic counselors. And what he's saying there is you'd be like, oh, good. The attorney general said I had the right. But no, don't feel great about that. The reason he's bringing it up is because he knows that this is definitely something that they're going to be looking at. They're going to be looking at ways to say, not only can you not offer someone an abortion, but you're not even allowed to discuss it with them. And yes, all of this means that someone who has less resources, less money, speaks a different language, is young, has developmental issues, is less educated. All of those things make you less able not only to have the money to travel out of state, but to sort of know how to facilitate it, right?
Like step one of that, of even figuring out what your options are. That's right. A great point, Laura. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just money, but money is important, but all these things mean how many times does a genetic counselor step in? And these aren't early abortions. I've been writing about this for a couple of years now because I felt that Roe was at stake. It said, you know, so medical abortion is going to be this huge difference maker. We're not going back to a pre-Roe era. The existence of, yes, it's terrible that a certain number of people are going to run into trouble and possibly die because medical abortion, you know, because they'll be doing it without counseling, because they'll be buying drugs on the black market. There's really a lot of terrible things. And I'm not understating that. But for our patients, you know, medical abortion really isn't an option, right? So these are later procedures, complicated procedures. And it's always been the role of the genetic counselor to step in and help facilitate them because they're complicated. They involve,
yeah, you know, that's my job. I should have said I work in prenatal for those that don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you leave people without that, you sort of say, I can't help you. I can't tell you. I can't give you any information. The very sophisticated customer is going to go home and, you know, call an old college classmate who lives in a different state and get a name and get a name of a place and figure it out and do it maybe without having to Google it because we're worried about the surveillance state and everything that's going on. All of this is not going to be in place tomorrow, but we worry about it over time.
We need to start planning and be aware of this. I think one thing too, is that I saw on Twitter as I was just learning from hashtag Gene Chat, which is great. It used to be GC Chat. Joanna underscore URLI really brought to my attention that genetic counselors have never had to practice in a time without Roe because we're a relatively new field. And I was like, wow, I didn't even realize that. So I know we've kind of been talking about it, but what are the legal ramifications for genetic counselors to discuss abortions in these banned states? I mean, like, if I move to Oklahoma, can I say, hey, I have colleagues up in New York and Connecticut? Like, if this is something that you want to pursue, I mean, could even my pedigrees be subpoenaed if I write someone had a termination and they figure out the year? I mean, these are things that are coming up on Twitter.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
yeah, yeah. No, so
crazy,
those are two different things. There's two different things.
Two different
things. Depends. And so the first thing is there legal jeopardy for genetic counselors? I can already say yes, but you have to know your own state. So if you're in Oklahoma right now, actually, yes, you can go and say whatever you want to say to your patient because that wasn't a part of their law. There are two examples I can give you already in place where there's been legal jeopardy associated with what you might say. The obvious one is SB8 in Texas. Now, do I think that SB8 is the model for what these laws will look like? No, SB8 was crafted to try and get around Roe, and it's clunky and weird and this vigilante thing. I don't really think so. I don't think that's what they're digging, but who knows? But SB8 created liability for medical professionals who in any way assisted someone in getting an abortion. So that could definitely be construed as sort of offering it, suggesting it, helping to facilitate it, and so on. You could be taken to court, your institution could be taken to court and fined up to $10,000. So yeah, that's a huge problem. And it didn't get tested in court because of the complications they introduced in the way they made it. I don't want to go into spend too much time on it, but it didn't get tested out in court. So there will still, I believe, be a process where the question comes before the courts, first state courts, and then federal courts, about whether or not it is permissible to write a law saying you can't talk about this. And I'd like to say that what feels obvious to, I think, all of us, wherever you really stand on abortion, even if you're that the idea that sort of saying you can't speak the truth to your patient, this is an option that they have. This does exist, you know, this can be dealt with medically in other places. The idea that you can't speak the truth to your patient feels like something that should be protected by the courts. But I look at precedents, for example, like script laws, where you have to say things to your patient that aren't true. Abortion is associated with breast cancer. There are multiple states where you're required to state that abortion is associated with breast cancer. We know there's no association between abortion and breast cancer. So I don't trust that the courts as configured right now will protect that. And I think it is a big issue and something that we really kept, and maybe the most primary place for us to try and get involved as an organization to fight it, you know, to because on a state-by-state level, we need to make the argument that this is going to put our patients at risk. The other area where there's already been liability has to do with these reason bans. Again, these reason bans, the people who wrote them pretended that they're about disability rights, but they were never about disability rights. They were never anti-eugenic. They were simply measures to try and create more obstacles to abortion. So I don't know if we'll continue to see reason bans when they can just pass laws that make abortion illegal. But in fact, in Arizona, the law they passed about a year ago said that a medical provider, this is us, could be in legal jeopardy if they knew that someone was planning to get an illegal abortion and didn't tell on them. Okay, so that violates some, but I have to say the courts did not allow that piece of the law to go into effect.
Okay, so we're still okay on that front so far.
Yeah, so that was a state court, and it's not a decision for all things. And it was a kind of a particular to that type of law. And I don't know what all these, so I'm not saying we have to look out for SB 8 is going to be the model. I'm not saying the Arizona reason ban is going to be the model. I would say that neither of these are going to be the model, but I would say that it's definitely on the radar screen of people who write these laws to restrict counseling. They know that we're facilitators, right? They know that we're the people saying, can I help you, to people who want to terminate a pregnancy.
Yeah,
and definitely. We are absolutely on the radar screen. And what I feel confident of is that laws will be passed, or laws will be written that will try and restrict our ability to counsel. Whether or not they'll be successful, I can't say, but this is definitely something for us to be vigilant about.
Yeah, we need to keep our eyes on this shifting over time, because you know this just happened recently. As you said, we've been expecting this.
How do you like spending the summer? In my free time, I'm usually with friends at our apartment's pool. My spot is right next to the water, reading a book, most recently A Crack in Creation, which might come up on a future episode. I like keeping cool by sipping on some iced tea while I read, but I don't like all the sugar. So I've been enjoying Sound drinks instead. Sound makes unsweetened organic sparkling waters made with tea and botanicals. No natural flavors or sugar. My fave is the blueberry with cinnamon and hibiscus tea. Try it out by ordering at drinksound.com using promo code DNA today for 20% off. Again, that's drinksound.com with promo code DNA today for 20% off your order, plus you're supporting the podcast. Speaking of friends in my apartment, a bunch of them have dogs, and I love being able to offer them a treat when I take them for a walk or they visit my place. So I got Sundays for Dogs. Now, this is dog food, but it can also be used as dog treats. My friend Annie's dog Frank gets so excited when he sees me, and if I'm being honest, I think it's more the food than me. Sundays for Dogs is real food formulated by a vet with high-quality meats, veggies, fruits, and superfoods, then air-dried to perfection. Since you're a DNA Today listener, you can visit sundaysfordogs.com and use code DNA Today for 35% off your order. Support your pup and the podcast.
One question to cover some exceptions before, you know, I'm keeping my eye on the clock here. How does this affect pregnancies that are non-viable? So I'm thinking pregnancies like certain, you know, types of OI, osteogenesis imperfecta, certain terminal forms of dwarfism. I mean, there's a lot of even ones that maybe don't have a genetic condition, but we see, okay, the brain hasn't developed or something that's very severe. We say this baby is not going, even if it does go to term, baby is not going to live more than a couple of hours, a few days. I mean, these are situations that as genetic counselors, we're very much involved in and helping them process. Is this something that you want to, you know, end the pregnancy at this point, or do you want to continue? I mean, this is one that, like, I think when I saw, I was like, what about those pregnancies? And obviously right. State by state once again, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, so this is the exceptions, right? So many of these laws will hold exceptions. Sometimes they might be exceptions for if the fetus has died, if the fetus is not viable, if the pregnancy is threatening the life of the pregnant individual. Those exceptions will be in many, if not all laws.
Okay, but that's somewhat reassuring to hear.
Wait, I'm sorry.
You're just going to burst my bubble there, Laura.
I am. No. But the problem is, this is very bad. There are no actual definitions, right? Like, so you're describing actual situations. And these laws are not written by medical people. And there's no definition of what is a severe, what is lethal. Does a lethal anomaly mean that every child born with that condition in the history of humankind has died? You know, there's such things as, like, you know, mosaicism and so on. We know that there's always a spectrum. So is it the 99% of the fetuses that are born with this have to be, you know, does it mean that they have to die within the first minute after birth? What if, you know, it's Tay-Sachs and everybody dies, but they, you know, miss a few years. So where are the lines drawn on all this? And actually, this is true with the health of the pregnant individual too, where it's like, okay, do we have to wait? I mean, literally you're hearing stories of people saying an ectopic pregnancy, they can't go in there and end an ectopic pregnancy.
I was wondering that too, because that's not a viable pregnancy. And that puts the pregnant person at immense risk.
And they're literally, I read yesterday about a state where they're putting in a standard of like, you have to, I don't actually remember, I don't want to be very specific whether this was a given hospital system or state, or, but they were talking about in one case, they're like, okay, well, we have to see their hemoglobin start to drop. Like, in other words, we know that pregnancy is not viable. You can't go in there and end it until you can show that the person's life is literally in that moment threatened.
But if it's ectopic and you can see that on an ultrasound, I mean, maybe sometimes you can, but I don't know. I guess you'd have to prove that it's ectopic.
So 100%. All of these things, what we are seeing is that from the practitioner's point of view, they're very frightened. The person who's being penalized is not the pregnant individual, right? It's the practitioner. Now that may also change over time. Right now,
right, but that's a good point.
And they're very nervous. I mean, we've seen this in other situations before, to be honest, like Catholic hospitals that don't do abortions. There's some terrible stories about people allowed to get septic and come near death before they were willing to go in there and end a pregnancy that was it, that was dying, like, or perhaps even gone. So like all of these exceptions, what they do is they sound good on paper, but clinically they create tons of questions. And the question is like, are we going to allow people to be cautious and err on the side of ending a pregnancy that's threatening that individual's life early before it gets, or are we going to say like, we're going to wait until they're on death's door and being like, okay, now. And then you're going to see situations like that story out of Ireland, which actually changed the law in Ireland, where a woman was allowed to die seeking an abortion where they knew the pregnancy was putting her life at risk. But they were like waiting. Cause it was like, it wasn't imminent. Her death wasn't imminent enough for her.
And then once it is too late,
it was too late and she died. So there's this story out of Ireland, which actually led to changes in the law there. And so,
but it takes that sometimes for laws to change. And even then sometimes laws don't change.
Right. So we're very concerned, and the way that these laws are structured, where really there's tons of risk associated with moving forward quickly, and not much risk associated with for the practitioner, but tons of risk for the patient, right?
Right.
So yes, the exceptions are going to save some people, but they're also creating an area of great uncertainty and challenge. And I can see a lot of, honestly, I'm worried for the mental health of genetic counselors in these situations, like advocating for people in situations where they know that these people are going through hell, either because the pregnancy is not viable or the person's health is at risk and they're frightened and scared and stuff. Imagine over and over again, being in that position and having, you know, people tell you, no, we can't do anything. It's very frustrating, upsetting. And I wonder, you know, are people going to be willing to work in prenatal care in these settings? When, you know, on the one hand, they'll be doing a great thing for the world in working there. And many of them will, you know, have a chance to go above and beyond for people. On the other hand, you know, I talk to people in Texas right now, and they're at work and they're worried about getting taped on phone calls, getting tricked into saying something where they could be fined $10,000. And I mean, you know, job's hard enough, right? Like,
oh yeah. Yeah. No, I really feel for my fellow prenatal genetic counselors in these states. If anyone wants to reach out and just vent, process, I'm certainly here and you know, someone that you can talk to. And I think, you know, I'm mindful of the time here. I know that you are very busy this week fielding interviews. I think my last question is also in that exception line. If someone has had a miscarriage that doesn't resolve on its own, where, you know, it naturally is passed, can people still have D&C, D&E, these procedures that are, you know, considered, I mean, they're not considered terminations because the baby's already died, but these are, I don't know, could they be considered abortions where they're under the ban for states?
So I think, yes, the procedure, it's not the procedure itself that's against the law. So technically everywhere you could have a D&C for fetal remains.
Okay.
But the worry here that's being brought up, and it's significant, and we know it's significant because it's already been a problem, is criminalizing the patient. So are people going to be afraid, particularly people who feel outside the system, right? Like, so this has been so disproportionately used against Black and Brown people. It's like, let's just make that very much clear. So there are places where there's laws against sort of harming your fetus, right? If you would take a drugs or whatever. Some of those have been misapplied to turn going into the hospital because you're having a miscarriage into a criminal offense. So now with abortion bans, much huger deal. And the question is, are people going to be frightened? Or if they've had a medical abortion that was illegal, and we should get the word out there that that drug doesn't stay in your system very long. I don't want to give the exact number of hours because I'm not 100% sure I'll get it right, but you know, they can't prove that, but who isn't going to be afraid to go into the ER? I mean, that's one of the big worries, that people will wait too long to go into the ER when they are having hemorrhages and so on, and put themselves in harm's way because they're afraid that they're going to be prosecuted for having a legal abortion. So in the same way here, it's hard. It's not always very clear to be able to tell.
None of this is clear.
None of be able to tell the difference. And I guess the part of it that makes me so angry is knowing that despite the language of this being for everyone, none of this is for everyone. I feel like they should be forced to say, we are making abortion illegal for some people.
Yes.
Right. And that disproportionately affects what happens to them during that pregnancy, who has those choices, but it doesn't end there. It disproportionately affects them for the rest of their life. Whether that means that you're the family that ends up taking care of a severely disabled child and adult for the, and deals with that for the rest of your life. Or whether it means that you are in poverty for the rest of your life because your education was interrupted, or because, I mean, we know there's very good evidence from the Turnaway study that the effects of not being able to get an abortion when you need an abortion don't end at the end of the day. Like you carry them with you for the rest of your life. It's not like we have room to make the social divides worse in this country. Like, it's already terrible. And yes, you know, many families who have a child with disabilities, that's a wonderful and joyous experience for them, and they love that individual. But more so, and even many of those families would say they want people to have the choice, that those people, they know what they can take on and what they're in a position to do and so on, and what they're in a position to handle. And when you take that away from people, but you don't just take it away from everybody, you sort of say, like, these people have no choices and the rest of the world does.
The haves and have nots in that sense.
I think a lot of people, including a lot of people with genetic conditions, are really going to suffer.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It's certainly something that is, you know, very disturbing.
Did you know PerkinElmer Genomics was one of the first laboratories to offer whole genome sequencing on a clinical basis? whole genome sequencing can maximize clinical diagnostic yield for patients. With turnaround time of 4 weeks for the proband sample, PerkinElmer's whole genome sequencing test is designed to provide access to additional valuable information compared to an exome. PerkinElmer also offers prenatal whole genome sequencing as well as ultra-rapid whole genome sequencing for critically ill newborns using dried blood spots. The ultra-rapid genome has a turnaround time of 5 days and includes mito, chromosomal CNV analysis, STR-TNR screening, and biochemical analysis. Also, listen back to episode 176 with Dr. Maduri Hegde, where we explore the power of whole genome sequencing, which also happens to be one of my favorite episodes of DNA Today. And stay tuned for a couple more episodes with PerkinElmer soon. Discover all that PerkinElmer Genomics has to offer at PerkinElmerGenomics.com. HemaShare Therapeutics is dedicated to developing therapies that help improve the lives of people with rare genetic diseases. HemaShare is currently conducting a clinical trial for a potential new treatment for two ultra-rare genetic metabolic diseases called propionic acidemia and methylmalonic acidemia. Learn more about HemaShare and these ultra-rare metabolic diseases in episode 188 of DNA Today. You can also visit HemaShare.com. That's HemaShare.com.
As we end here, are there any resources, organizations that you want to point people to? I mean, certainly this is something that I would like to donate to causes. I'm not sure where the best place is for, you know, the podcast money to be able to make those donations.
Yeah. Well, I can send you a list and maybe you can put it up or something.
That sounds good.
If I say something else. But I will say, in the immediate sense, New York Magazine did a great issue. It's a cover story. And they are making, they have created a state-by-state list of resources, and that includes articles on where you can get medical abortions and on what's available. And they are making that all free without a paywall for everybody. So good for them. And that's a good source. And I have students right now working with the Genuine Collective to create a state-by-state resource for genetic counselors specifically, to help them understand what are the laws in not only their own state but abutting states, and you know, so that help them be able to find places to send patients and also places to send patients that will help them if they don't have the money. So we're working on that, but obviously that's going to take a little bit of time. But the Genuine Collective is definitely something to support as a genetic counselor if you're if you are frustrated and angry and you want to do something helpful.
Okay, great. We'll include links to all of that in the show notes. And I assume once your students have that up and running, you'll send that to the Sarah Lawrence email list as like an update.
We'll be trying to get it out as much, but it's going to take some time.
Yes, but it will still be relevant, unfortunately, whenever it does come out.
So this is for the long haul. This is the fight for the long haul. I'm a little tired, you know, I'm not that young, but hell, we're in it for the long haul.
You've been doing the good work of the communications for people. And I just really appreciate you, especially being a last minute interview here. So thank you for bestowing all of your knowledge onto myself and the listeners. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, you can check out The Beagle Has Landed, and especially the abortion law episode with Jordan Brown, I believe it was a really good episode of yours.
So
thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Good to be here. Thanks for putting a spotlight on this.
Don't forget to help us defend our title as the best science and medicine podcast. Go to podcastawards.com and select DNA Today in the science and medicine category. And here's a bonus. If you tweet or post that you nominated DNA Today and of course tag us, then we will share your post and give you a shout out on the show as a thank you. Again, that's podcastawards.com, DNA Today for the science medicine category. You have the power to get DNA Today nominated again. So please go nominate us. I'm begging you. Podcastawards.com. Be sure to tune in next week on July 8th. We have a very special guest joining us, Atticus Schaefer. You may know Atticus as playing the beloved Brick on ABC's The Middle. Loved the show, watched it growing up, and he shares his experience of having osteogenesis imperfecta. So you're not going to want to miss this episode. For more information about today's episode, visit dnapodcast.com, where you can also stream all episodes of the show. We encourage your questions, comments, guest pitches, and ideas. Send them all into info@dnapodcast.com. Search DNA Today on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, so you can connect with us there. And a favor, please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. DNA Today is hosted and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our social media lead is Corinne Merlino. Our video lead is Amanda Andrioli. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.